So, welcome to my talk. This is actually a talk I gave at the Chicago Roadshow back in May, but it was the super short version because I only had about 15 minutes to give it. So now we get the longer, more expanded version, which I'm excited to give. So before I get started, how many people here are in roles where they have like management responsibility, they get to make decisions? Okay, we've got a few. How many folks here are, hey, I'm an individual contributor and I just do my work and making decisions is somebody else's problem? Awesome. Okay, so this is about the spread I was hoping for. This talk is definitely for you, but it is also for people in management because management is kind of layered and tiered. So even if you're in charge of your little small segment of the world, there are certain things you're not going to be in charge of. And when you're on top, you're just in charge of everything, but you don't want to be in charge of everything most of the time. So this talk should have a little bit for everybody. So a little bit about me. So my name's Bob Paulin again. I'm from Chicago. I am an ASF member. I have been for about 3 years. I contribute to a lot of different projects because my clients use a lot of various software, but the ones that I am a committer and PMC on is Apache Tika, and I am a committer on Felix. So OSGI containers, document processing are two things that I kind of fell into and got into in the ASF enough to be elected to be a part of those communities. I'm very, very deeply into Java. My work as an independent consultant is usually doing JVM work for clients in Chicago and in the Midwest. I run a few podcasts, so the Java Off Heap podcast is kind of a news podcast, and then the Java Pub House is kind of a how-to in Java. So I've been doing it for several years now, so if you're looking for the news, Off Heap. If you're looking for how do I do certain things in Java while you're out for a jog, Java Pub House is the one to do. I'm also a Java champion. So the Apache Way, we've had a few talks on this track on the Apache Way. So if you've been on this track for some time, you've probably had a lot of different flavors of the Apache Way. This is an unofficial kind of culture that we have here at the ASF, and people define it in different ways. This is kind of how I've broken it down, and this is mostly based on the work of other people trying to make it concise and break it into kind of a almost like a value system of these are the things that we do and we find important. The thing that's interesting about the Apache Way is it was something that we came up with kind of almost just as we were going, right? So it was, they talked about it in the keynotes, that this is a culture that kind of evolved. It's like, well, we just tried it and it worked. So we kept doing it. So these values come from people doing things, people finding out what's working, and they're sticking around because they like to work under these parameters and with these values. We don't have to be here. We're volunteers. Some of us are paid to be here. That's great. But at the end of the day, most of us are choosing to be here because we like to work this way, myself included. So the thought can occur to some of us that maybe aren't paid open source developers or are working for companies that maybe are just consumers of open source and they're not producing anything is, can we bring some of this culture into our workplace? You know, I do this, most of my work from Apache, I'm a consultant. Some of it is for clients where it's like, okay, yeah, you can contribute that up. But a lot of my work for Apache is kind of more after hours stuff where I'm not billing, where it's just for my own interest. So I like working that way. So for me, it's, you know, how can I bring this to my clients? But companies have different hierarchies. There's different things that maybe make some of these values incompatible hard. And we start coming up with all of these excuses, especially when we're in those individual contributor roles. You know, I'm not the boss. This is somebody else's problem. The last time I tried to do this, it was hard, and I'm not going there again. You know, leadership doesn't get it, and they'll never get it. And we kind of become a little bit negative on change in our own organizations because we don't feel like we can do it. So when you think about this, we have some experience in our lives changing someone's mind where we're talking to a friend or we're talking to a coworker and we are able to influence someone that we don't actually have any authority over. So it's a peer relationship or, an outside of work friend relationship. So we have had some experience influencing change on people in our lives. Maybe we've had that experience and it's hard. But there are these really annoying people that our companies keep bringing in. So they're actually paid to create change and they don't have titles and they tell us what to do even though they don't work at our companies. And they're called consultants. So these people come in and they don't have any authority and they create change. So while this is annoying, this is also a good thing to model how you can make change without actually having an authority. So the question then becomes, what can we learn from how consultants influence change and use as individuals without, becoming annoying consultants? So I read a book. So before I got into being an independent, I did a lot of reading on how to do consulting. And I've actually become convinced that consulting is a learned thing. Nobody goes into life saying, I'm just going to give people advice or help people do things and never actually have any authority or be in charge. Most people kind of want that authority and want to be recognized for that. But some of us find out that we're a lot better at doing these things and we learn throughout our lives a way to become influential within organizations without actually having that authority. So Jerry Weinberg wrote this book called Secrets of Consulting. He passed away last year. But he has done a ton of writing over the course of his life on consulting, on systems thinking, that I've done a lot of reading of. And, this book is basically a gold mine of how to get people to do things without actually having to force them to do things. And he does a lot of his writing as narratives. So he writes in a way where he's just kind of, it almost feels like he's rambling, but he's telling a story, and then when you get to the end, it's like, I see what you did there. Great read. Definitely check it out. But I've tried to model this talk a bit after that, trying to use narrative to explain situations I've been in where I've been able to influence folks that I did not have any authority over, which is something that I'm in quite a bit, being an annoying consultant myself. So one of the stories he's talking in this book, he's talking to a rancher with a group of people, and the conversation is all about how nobody's listening to them in different aspects. Some of it's family, some of it's business, and the rancher at the end is talking about his problems and how he's been solving with buffaloes. If you have a buffalo, the buffalo, you can't force the buffalo. So as long as a buffalo will go anywhere it wants, so long as it wants to go there. Buffalo is a big animal. Most people can't just put a collar around it and force it. But you can also keep a buffalo out of anywhere just as long as they don't want to go for it. This, in my mind, really does a good job of summing up what being influential means. It's convincing people that this is something they want to do when maybe they haven't done it before, or maybe they don't. Or maybe something that they don't want to do by convincing them that this will be a bad thing for them. So let's talk about, this kind of boils down to how do we influence teams that we're a part of to adopt things that are in the Apache way? So our teams are basically our buffalo. We don't actually have any authority. We have to just try to influence them to want to go in that direction. One of the things I found out, and apparently a lot of other folks that study human beings have found out, is most people try to avoid pain. Human beings, as a species, is kind of loss-averse. If something hurts, we don't want to do it. And it ends up being a very powerful motivator to get people to go places where maybe they're not sure if it's going to be better, but, hey, I might avoid this pain, so I might just actually try it. So getting the Apache way in your organization is really kind of one of the easiest ways is to identify pain that you're having on your teams and figure out a way to influence people to see how the Apache way will solve those problems. So we're going to talk about a couple different organizational pain points where I've realized and had some experience with the Apache way making it, making some of the pain go away. So the very first one I'd like to go into is called tribal knowledge. So who's heard the term tribal knowledge before? Great. So the most extreme example I've had of tribal knowledge involves a buddy of mine who just went to a new company. This new company has a software architect that designed a significant portion of the system of the systems at this company, some very critical stuff, and has, over the years, has drifted in and become a man that just kind of lives up in the mountains. And every couple of months, couple of weeks, he will come down from the mountain to talk to the people at this company when they have questions about the software. I know it sounds ridiculous, but this is actually what my buddy has gone to this company and is having to deal with, because they want to change the software that the man on the mountain wrote. There are certain people in the company that understand subsystems of this because the man in the mountain has explained it to them. Naturally, this project is C++. But the man on the mountain kind of established this system. There's a certain amount of people that know certain things about the system, and the only way to understand how the system works is to talk to the man in the mountain. We have this in our organizations in less extreme versions when we talk about, you know, closing off source code repositories, having it so only people on certain teams can commit to certain repositories. So in many cases, we have this situation in our companies without maybe having it so extreme where it's just literally one person in the mountain. When you talk about Apache, this is something that we're sort of allergic to, right? So the Apache way establishes, hey, we're all peers, and when we're on these projects, we're of equal value on these projects and equal authority. So we try to get rid of the benevolent dictator for life thing, right? So one thing we do in Apache is we try to document things about our software. We try to make sure that if somebody leaves the project, which happens frequently because of various reasons, that there's enough there to keep the project alive. In fact, that is one of the things that the ASF is really good about, and we get actually a ton of slack for it, is we have a ton of software projects that everybody is telling each other are deprecated, but the communities are still alive producing software. I mean, you hear about the Equifax Struts vulnerability, people look at each other, there's people still using Struts. There's still a community around Struts. They are still producing releases. There are people that find this software important. So it's actually kind of an interesting feature that you have all of these people talking about Struts. Oh, well, we've all moved on. Some people haven't moved on, and some people can keep those things alive. The Apache Software Foundation is very good at keeping software alive well beyond when the public thinks it should last that long. So let's talk about, you know, how do we deal with tribal knowledge? One of the things that I found is documenting for different zip codes is kind of the theme that I would use. And it's interesting in the ASF how we do this, because we have people from all over the world that are contributing. So when we put together documentation, some of it is just using simple language, not using sophisticated English language where somebody that maybe is not a native speaker has to look up every single word. But understanding that you're not documenting for the people that are local and the people that are around you. So there's certain things that we assume that just everybody knows. Well, you could just look at the code and figure that out. But people that are not familiar with the code, we can lower the bar by explaining, you know, how this works, trying to imagine ourselves in that other person's position where they're just coming onto a project. And the best way to do this is to actually have a new person write that documentation. Or if you stub it out, have somebody look at it that is new and tell you where it is confusing and broken, and actually don't tell them, well, you're stupid, you don't understand my document. But improve the document and have them rewrite it in a way that they would understand it. So you're there to more supervise and make sure that the document still meets technically correct language, but maybe is written from the eyes of the beginner. Another thing is kind of similar to this, but it's documentation for dummies. Because within your organization, not everybody that is going to need this and that could contribute to your project is going to be a developer, right? So, you know, I have managers that are that will say, explain this to me like I'm five. And I like that term because a lot of times then you start taking a lot of the jargon out or at least defining the jargon before you use it. So some of the things that we use in a tribal sense are acronyms, are abbreviations, are jokes, perhaps. I mean, if those of you that went to James Gosling's keynote was showing a command option that the BS command, right? While a really funny joke, you know, and some of that can bring an internal tribe of people together, from outsiders that don't get the joke, that's noise, right? So while funny, if you're creating a lot of documentation like that on your projects, it can push outsiders outside your tribe away. So some of it is just understanding that you're when you're writing documentation, you're not writing documentation for your tribe, you're writing documentation for people outside the tribe. Okay, so pain point number two, man there, who's seen The Wizard of Oz? So you'll get the use of Professor Marvel. So that's The Wizard of Oz before they go into the dreamscape. So I worked with an architect on a project. And, you know, when you talk about, first of all, when you talk about behind the mirror decision making, a lot of times we're assuming the really bad stuff, like, hey, all the bosses go into a room, sort of the things James Gosling was talking about when he's like, hey, you know, corporate boardrooms are making this and they're excluding people on purpose. They're making decisions in bars. This behind the mirrors decision making doesn't require somebody to even be trying to exclude you on purpose. So Professor Marvel was somebody that I worked with on a project, so his, just to keep his anonymity, where he was a very, very outgoing and personable architect, and he would take it upon himself to go around to the different teams, and he would talk to everybody on those different teams, and they would have meetings, and they would define directions for a lot of the different products and software that they had in this company. But what would end up happening is everybody would come out of these meetings feeling really good because, you know, he was a principal architect at this company, so he had authority to do a lot of different things and empower people to make changes. But a couple months down the line, you would see these projects start to struggle. And a lot of times it was when they were trying to integrate with one another. So the directions they were coming up with in all of these individual meetings they were happening turned out to be sometimes conflicting. Sometimes they required changes from other teams. Sometimes those teams weren't involved in those decisions and they got really mad that now their hand is being forced because of a decision being made in this meeting that they weren't a part of. So while Professor Marvel had all of these really good intentions, because of how he was kind of moving around and things were not being publicly brought together, because Professor Marvel's brain can only hold so many things, all of these decisions looked to all the other teams like they were happening in isolation, like they were happening behind the mirror, and they had no influence over it. So within Apache, there's a saying as, if it didn't happen on the list, it didn't happen. So we have sort of this culture of pushing decision-making out into the public so that it's visible. So the only excuse that you didn't see it is you weren't paying attention, which generally makes people feel a little bit bad about it instead of being angry that you made a decision without them. So having some of the decision-making or all of the decision-making happening in public is a little bit challenging for companies, right? So not all of this you want them these things to be anonymous. It's almost as if in Apache you're having multiple projects trying to come together and agree on things, is what it usually feels like. But there's ways to, within companies, that even as not being a boss and just saying, okay, I know all decisions and I'm going to track everything in my head and make sure there's no conflicts, that an individual can help with this decision-making process, this transparency. And I call this setting decision-making on info. So when you're logging and you set it to info, you're at least getting all the things that are important. So being able to have a log of decisions and have individuals contribute to a public log of decisions where anybody can see it within a company. So if you're in a meeting, having somebody conscious enough to say, we are making this decision, these are the reasons why, this is the date we made it, this was who was there. So you can make sure that everybody that was in the room had agreed on something. That decision is now public, so if it involved other people and those people weren't there, we can call that out and we can review it. If we change our minds and people have started going along on the decision log and started building things, we have something to reference back. Most companies have a wiki or something that can track these things. So, you know, having the idea of publicizing decisions in a meeting is not something that's usually out of reach at a company. The other thing that happens very frequently in companies that doesn't always seem to happen at, or doesn't seem to happen very much at Apache, is people don't realize they're making decisions. So you'll say something and you'll walk out and you all agree, and there's some implicit decision that was made that you just haven't even thought of. Or it was made, somebody said something that sounded like everybody was in agreement, but nobody actually noticed that there was a decision, so nobody wrote it down, but it impacted another team or your team because you changed your mind in a later meeting. One of the things I found really effective, and it's something that we do at Apache, is having somebody that summarizes the decision, that a decision is being made. Because when people are trying to agree on something on list, usually there is somebody stating the problem, usually somebody restating the problem, and then if it's controversial, there may be a vote, there may be arguments, there may be something. So it's very obvious that a decision is being made and we have a process for it. In meetings, that doesn't always happen. So in meetings, it could just be somebody being appointed or somebody or being raising their hand and says, it sounds like we're making a decision here. This is the decision I think we're making. And if people agree that that's the decision, again, it's recorded, and then you can argue the pluses and minuses, the merits or demerits of the action that's being taken. But sometimes it's just having somebody that says, we're making a decision in the meeting to make that more clear within an organization. So, micromanager. So, nobody wants to be a micromanager. I certainly don't want to be a micromanager because as a consultant, usually you're building something to give to somebody else. So the idea of having to micromanage something at a client is really, really scary. However, I have gotten myself in this sort of a situation before working for a client. It was like one of those dream projects where they're like, here's a blank canvas, go build us something awesome. This is the problem. We will, you know, whatever you want to do, we will do it. So I was working on a project like this, building things out, setting up servers, writing code, shipping code, and I was trying to do all the things that I was talking about in the previous stories. I was creating documentation. I was trying to make sure that people understood it. We were doing code reviews, all of those things. But at the end of the project, once we shipped it, I found I was still getting all the production support calls. They're like, Bob knows this. We're going to go to Bob. I know you have a document, but, you know, you probably would do it faster. So why don't you start? You can do it. I'm going to assign the Jira to you. All the code reviews, geez, so Bob put all these comments on here, or I'm going to send all my code reviews to Bob so he can review everything. And sometimes I get a little nitpicky with the code reviews. So literally I was now the blocker on a number of projects because they couldn't commit it if Bob didn't look at it. You know, it became just an untenable situation for me because now I had all of this responsibility that consultants just don't want. What was that? Am I running out of time?
Nope.
Okay. So at Apache, we have a few different things that help us deal with kind of that situation where you have a single point of failure on your project, right? So all of our committers have equal access and can approve pull requests, can commit code sometimes even without issuing a pull request, right? So having commit rights means you can commit to the developer, the master branch, or however your branch is doing commits. And when you tell people that aren't familiar with Apache about this, they think it's crazy. It's like you allow people to commit to your repositories like without any sort of means of stopping them. And, you know, we don't usually kick people out. Like, this is really, really weird. And a lot of it is because, you know, within Apache, we have this sense of earned authority. So we have this idea that we enable people to have more flexibility on our projects that have shown that they are not going to break things or are responsible about when they are introducing something interesting or different or controversial, they're going to ask for that feedback. And even though they can commit directly, they're going to create the pull request so that they can get it evaluated and looked at. So how do we introducing some sort of measured risk-taking to our projects, our personal projects, can help here. And I've had had the subtitle of the story being The Art of Doing Nothing, because when this started to change is when I started to not do things, which was really, really interesting for me, because I'm, you know, as a consultant, you're paid hourly, so it's like if you're not doing things, you're not billing. But at the same time, when I stopped doing work, and some of it was because I had another project going on, people started looking around. It's like, well, I don't have time. You have to look at the document. You have to use it. I'm not able to do this for you. So stepping back kind of helped me out. And the analogy that I like to use on this is sort of the self-driving car. So everybody's familiar with the car. Right now, the laws are if you have a car, you still have to be sitting in the driver's seat. You can let the wheel there, but you have to be ready to take it at any point because you could run into a truck. Like, that happens. So when I kind of went into this mode where I stopped doing things, I was still watching what was going on. I was still receiving requests from people asking me to do it, but I learned to answer those questions differently than I'll just do it, or these are the exact steps you need to do. It was changing the conversation to, well, what have you tried already? Meaning, have you looked at some of the documentation? But I want to know specifically what you've looked at and how you think that the documentation is telling you how to do the thing. So being able to kind of not explain it to them, but understand their take on reading the directions or the code, even in that sense, of how it was working. Started asking, you know, questions like, when you're asked to do it, it's like, well, I don't, you know, feeling like trying to step back, maybe it's not my place to do this. Maybe you're now taking on this responsibility. Can you try it and tell me where it breaks, or tell me where you feel it's going wrong or where you don't understand? So the self-driving car is basically, you're watching it, and if it really, 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 really gets bad, then you can grab the wheel to save your life. But for the most part, you're trying to let the car drive itself as much as possible, even if you have the time, so that people start picking up the things that you're not doing. It was funny, I think Ted Dunning had the comment when I was talking to him about the incubator, about when that started working better. He's like, well, I stopped doing stuff and all these people just stepped up. So this is something that happens at Apache. People move on or they stop doing roles, and other people that it's important to them will pick it up. And sometimes we just don't trust it, but that's how it works most of the time. The other thing that I started doing more of is when people did pick things up, I would encourage that, and I would kind of give them that authority and say, this is the person to talk to. They know what they're talking about on these specific things. And when you come from a project where maybe you've been that benevolent dictator for life, or you're coming from a repo of code where you have that much authority, people will look to you for almost everything. So building other people up so that they can start achieving that level of authority will start driving people to them. And it feels kind of weird at first because most of the time we kind of like that for at least a little while. But having it forever is usually not a good situation. So just letting people do the work is one thing, but actually giving them the feedback, hey, you're doing this well, sending people to them, telling people that this is now the subject matter expert in a specific thing is really important, because then they feel, that person feels good and they'll probably take on more, and B, the people that see that and want to achieve that kind of status are also going to maybe start emulating them and start taking on more responsibility. The other thing that sort of happens when you do this that is a little bit unexpected is you may see your architecture start to change a little bit. Because you may be blind that you've actually been building the code base around yourself and around the things that you know. When other people start taking it over, they start doing things a different way. One of the things that happened on this project is I had all the Jenkins scripts in the source code. The resource that I was talking to that was taking it on started taking the things out. And while that kind of freaks me out at first, because now it's being put in another repo, which I could still see and potentially give pull requests to, it was different. But it gave this person ownership of those scripts, and I didn't have to worry about it anymore. When it broke, people went to him first. So I didn't have to worry about it anymore. And you may see your projects evolve, and it may feel weird, but sometimes that's part of the process of being able to take yourself out and understanding when you can do less on your projects but get more out of it. All right, so the last story I have is the bike shedding story. So this happened a while ago. This is actually really early in my consulting career. I was doing some work in the financial industry, and I was working with an architect where we were butting heads a lot. It seemed like philosophically we were different. You know, I was very, very pro open source. This other architect was, I'm just going to write it myself. Open source is for people with big egos, and I can do it better. A lot of not invented here. And what I found is during these meetings that we had when we discussed design, where we had to work together, is we ended up talking forever and not making any decisions because we were just arguing with each other over various things. And it was almost like, you know, you're being gaslit into not making decisions. It's like, do you really just not want to change anything? Because they found that sometimes that's effective for some people. So within that situation, eventually, you know, I was starting to get into Apache, and I started learning about how Descent works in Apache. And we all know, when we think of Descent in Apache, we're naturally drawn to the nasty message boards conversations where just the replies go on forever and people never seem to settle it. So you can even get this in Apache as well. But we do have a lightweight system for how you descent to code changes, to changes in your project. So you have your plus one is agreeing, your negative one is I don't care, and your negative one is the no, and your plus zero is you don't really care either way. And there's rules around when you get to use those things. And if people aren't following the rules, you can have that conversation and figure out how to move forward from there. It's a negative one in Apache. Typically, that's a veto in a number of code commit projects. So knowing when it's okay to veto or bike shed to oblivion is really important versus when do I just kind of back off and say, you know, this isn't actually this important. So one of the things that I ran into, especially with this architect, is being able to address the elephant in the room and understanding what the rules were when we were working around the elephant. Is anybody familiar with the elephant in the room concept? So I'll explain it. If there's some sort of underlying tension with another person, you know, a lot of people will say that you're maybe having an argument, but your argument isn't about what you're arguing about. There's some elephant hiding in the room that nobody can see that is this really big issue, but it's not visible to everyone else. One of the ways you can deal with some of that inner conflict, this in this case it was kind of the open source versus closed source problem, is addressing it directly and saying, stating, this is the elephant in the room. And sometimes the elephant in the room applies to the conversation you're having. Like, if we're talking about adding a dependency, for example, that dependency is open source, and we have a problem with writing ourselves versus the open source, that elephant may have a stake in that room. But a lot of times, the elephant has nothing to do with the conversation happening in the room. So by addressing it and stating, well, if this is our problem, this problem doesn't weigh into this decision. If you're vetoing things that I'm doing based on this, it's not really a valid. It's like providing a negative one without a real justification for why you're doing it. You're just doing it to inflict pain on another person. It makes it obvious when you state it that way. And people may not like that, but if they can't actually come up with the reason why they're negative wanting it that doesn't involve this elephant that has no business in that room, other people will take note of that, and usually it's something that gets worked out. The other thing is understanding that things do fail. So people are going to make bad decisions sometimes. And bad decisions, sometimes if they're made in the right context, leads to learning. So we learn from failure. That's one of the other things that were highlighted in the young lady that was up there for the Billion Kids to Code keynote. Understanding that a lot of disagreement on projects come from, hey, I think this is going to fail, or I think this is a bad idea. A lot of times it's speculative. Can create a lot of kind of roadblocks where because somebody thinks it's bad, somebody thinks it's good, but nobody actually has any evidence either way, you end up kind of getting hung up on that, and it becomes, well, we're not going to do anything. You're back to the bike shed, to oblivion, where since we don't know it, we're just not going to do anything. As someone that usually wants certain things to happen, sometimes it helps to talk about, okay, I acknowledge that what you're saying about this problem, adding this dependency, may cause this project to fail. Maybe the open source project goes away. Maybe they introduce a bug that hurts our software. But what do we learn from that experience? Is it that open source is bad? Is it that maybe this project, maybe we picked the wrong project? And defining what you would learn by making the mistake in the meeting where you're trying to make the decision can be helpful. So it's a matter of, what would I learn if everything went wrong? And then accepting that, you know what, that would probably be a good learning. So why don't we move forward? I don't know if you're right, but if you end up being right, this is the worst that could happen, and this is what we learned from this, and this is what we're going to do instead the next time. You sometimes go down that path, or sometimes you fail in a completely different way, but this gives the person that is raising these blocking arguments something to kind of hang their hat on. It's, okay, you are understanding this could fail, and that this is, this is something that we can do to respond to my concerns on this decision. So one of the purpose of this talk is just to kind of go through some of my narratives and some of the things that I've experienced that has helped bring Apache culture into some of the companies that I've consulted with. And really, it's all about finding change. It's all about finding your own narratives to some of these problems that you see within your companies that the Apache way could apply to and potentially solve for you. So, you know, one of the things I'm encouraging folks to do is think about some of these pain points. Think about some of the ways that some of the stories that you've had to be influential, and in using those to be influential within your companies to bring more of the open source culture into the corporate environments and the places that we work. mainly because, you know, if I end up working with you or you end up working with more Apache people, it's going to feel more at home. These are, again, things that we've come to embrace kind of on our own. And the more we spread these type of culture, the better I think the experience is going to be across the developer communities in general. So I thank you for your time. And if you're looking to follow me or have any conversations or trade stories afterwards, I'll be around till Friday. So thank you.